You know, everybody wants to be somebody. Yeah, everybody wants to be somebody, but on a magazine cover, on a magazine cover. Everybody wants to be somebody on television, television. Everybody wants to be somebody in the mouth of someone someday in the USA and in the world today. But nobody wants to struggle to be somebody. Nobody wants to suffer to be somebody. Everybody wants to be somebody if somebody is someone. But nobody wants to be no one if no one is nobody. Because in the world today, everybody wants to be famous. Famous. Everybody wants to be somebody famous. But nobody needs it. Nobody needs it. Everybody wants it. And everybody should be recognized as something. Everybody has the right to be something, something. But nobody wants to just be something, something, something. Everybody wants to be something, something famous, famous. But nobody needs it.
Good morning. This is Saturday Morning Live. You're listening to Radio Regent. That was Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters. So, it's another Saturday. We're here, heard every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we have a packed up show for you again. And we're going to go right into it and go right into Mamia Abu-Jamal.
When we look at allegiances abroad, we're struck by how seemingly nonsensical and even illogical they appear. That's only because we don't use the right lenses. For example, it was both tragic and foolish to see the so-called presidential debates, which were, by the way, hardly debates and rarely presidential. It was a national appeal to fear and a monument to ignorance. Quick, name one country that Iran has invaded. The honest among us will answer none. And the clever may name Iraq under Saddam. But in truth, he was the aggressor. Second question. Name one country Iran has occupied. Answer, none. But to the corporate media, Iran is an implacable foe. The U.S. media, never a reliable source for world history, paints a villain, and we growl like Pavlov's dogs. Let's try another quiz. Name a country that Israel has invaded. Answer. I bet you can't name only one. For they invade others so regularly, you can set a clock by it. And when the subject comes to, well, occupation, Israel has occupied Palestine for a lifetime. Guess who is America's tightest ally? You guessed it. Born out of the Cold War, based more on manic paranoia than fact. We replay the same old tunes, which no longer, if they ever did, serve the interests of the people of the U.S. The U.S., intent on extending its imperial dominance over others, racks up more and more enemies. This cannot end well. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Education. One new liquor naked. Must be plucked in song.
Bye. are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Los Angeles, California. And we have a very action-packed show for you today. And before I start the show today, I would like to thank Sandy Thompson for technical brilliance last week. And we ran out of time, but I would like to thank her before we even begin the show today. On today's show, we have two interviews with two filmmakers, Charles Burnett and Billy Woodbury. They're going to be taking place at 11:30 and at 12:30, which is, I guess, Pacific time. But we're also going to have a tribute to Eric Allen Dorphy, Jr., a great musician from Los Angeles, California. And I would like to begin the show like I begin every show, thanking O'Malley Ishitella, Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, and Archie Shepp. Chairman O'Malley Ishitella was the person who gave me the space here on Uhuru Radio to do whatever I do, and Archie Shepp was a human being that gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West but not of the West. But of course, we cheat, and we play music from the African continent itself. And if you wanted to get a hold of us, we have the email address is dj@uhururadio.com. The Skype option is Uhuru Radio, and the U.S. and Canadian telephone number is 727-565-1599, and the U.K. number is 020-8133-6629. And we are going to present some music from a young man who is now has a church in San Diego, California, a very brilliant singer by the name of DJ Rogers. We're going to listen to DJ Rogers.
I'm the one your eyes see. Tell me you need me deep down inside, like I need you. You see, I need you to see me through. I wanna hear you say, darling, darling. And through the cold, together we will never grow. Sometime the going will get a little tough, and I must admit, living with me can be rough, but I need you to see me. I get off when you say, baby, 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 I love you. Country, we'll settle on a piece of land. I just shake when you say, oh, 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 I love you.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from California. And we were listening to the music of DJ Rogers. But before we played DJ Rogers, we were listening to Don Silver. I forgot to give Don Silver some play. Don Silver, who is out of Sacramento, California. And she began her career with Sly and the Family Stone. She hooked up with P-Funk. She was a bride of Funkenstein. And for a second, she was she backed up Charlie Wilson and had a deal with Polygram Records. But we were listening to Don Silver and Brother DJ Rogers, who is now has a church in San Diego, California. But right now, we want to play some music from one of my favorite artists of all time. This is Leroy Hudson, who replaced Curtis Mayfield in the Impressions, and he also was very close to the late, great Donnie Hathaway. Listen to the music of Leroy Hudson.
Do the things you do to me each and every single Your apartment this morning, I could see you standing by the window picking out your hair. And while I stood there, I thought to myself, that sweet chocolate lady used to be mine, and now here I stay on the outside looking in. Wishing and hoping for something that I'd already had and didn't realize what I had when I had it. It was something very special, the kind of love that truly comes along just once in a lifetime. Well, I realize now that you have your own desires and aspirations in life. And I can think of a lot of things I'd do differently if I only had the chance. What my friends would always say, told me time would soon be coming when I'd want you back to stay. Serves me right to feel this heartache. Well, when I really can't be mad, I had all the love I could ever need. Didn't realize what I had, but I found out the hard way. No, 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 no. No matter what I try to do, I just can't stay away. Likes to know when she's appreciated. Love and trust are surely both related. And sometimes emotion has a way of hiding itself. Make you feel there's nothing left. Oh,
I can't stay away.
I just can't stay away. What I try to do. Listen, girl,
I can't stay away.
I need you here with me.
I just can't stay away
in this misery. Time to bring the little come. to her man and give him peace of mind. You always came to me. You came with the tender love and care. Sometimes at night when I think about it, it wakes me up, really turns me around. You tear me up inside. I think about it, I'll let you get away.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from California today. And we were listening to the music of Leroy Hudson, So In Love, and a great singer who replaced Curtis Mayfield in The Impressions. And joining me on the line is Charles Burnett, a producer and director. He's also a writer, editor, actor, photographer, and a cinematographer. His most popular films include Killer of Sheep, which was done in 1977, My Brother's Wedding, 1983, To Sleep with Anger, 1990, The Glass Shield, 1994, and Namibia, The Struggle for Liberation, that was done in 2007. And Burnett has been involved in other types of motion pictures, including shorts, documentaries, a TV series, and made-for-TV movies, including Oprah Winfrey's Presents The Wedding. That was done in 1988. And joining me now is Charles Burnett. How are you doing today, Mr. Burnett?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful.
Good, good.
I basically wanted to begin with, you know, you have a great body of work, but I'm really interested in, like, this year, in 2013, what are you currently working on?
Well, I'm working right now on this documentary about you know, the 1960s integration of the hospitals in the South, and in fact all over, but basically in the South. And we've done some shooting. We're trying to you know, look for grants and other funding to complete the project. And that, and
right.
And then working on the script as well for about microfinancing.
Microfinancing?
Yeah, we don't try to do a feature about microfinancing.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, we have a half an hour, so we have a little time, but I wanted to basically get your thoughts on the Django Unchained controversy. How do you see that whole the film and the whole discussion about it?
I think it's very interesting, and it certainly brought this whole thing about slavery to the table, you know. And I was at the forum we had over at S1 Bookstore when you were there, you know, and you saw the passion in people that really identified with and wanted to see more films like to the Django and the subject of slavery, you know. The thing I had was that, you know, people thought it depicted slavery, gave a good example of slavery, and I thought there was this, it's much more than that. It's a lot deeper than that. And so, you know, I liked the film, but I didn't think it really depicted slavery the way it really is, you know. But that's subjective, and everyone else has a right to their opinion and vice versa. So leave it with that.
Well, I think that you, having been born in Mississippi, probably have heard some. I know that there's no one that you knew, or any of your relatives that were living were probably actually lived during the slavery period. But I mean, coming out of Mississippi, that was one of the hot spots of slavery. I think South Carolina and Mississippi Mississippi in particular had a lot of hangings. But the last thing I want to ask you about Django is that there was a small victory in the sense that the Dolls have been banned. All of those Dolls, they had a big press conference, I think, in Leimert Park, and I just read that the Dolls, they have been pulled. What are your thoughts on that?
I haven't seen them, and so I was kind of mystified of what they were talking about in a sense. I really haven't seen them. I heard about it, but I haven't seen, at all, any of those items.
Right.
So I can't even comment. I'm like Spike Lee. I can't comment on it. I haven't seen them.
All right. But since this is a Hoover Radio, and it's really dealing with a lot of issues dealing with Africa and African people, I think listeners to this particular show would really be interested in all your work, but in particular the movie you did on Namibia, because a lot of people I know have not seen or even heard of that film. Could you talk about what the film deals with and how it came about?
Yeah, well, the film deals with the struggle of Southwest Africa and how it became independent and got the name of Namibia. It goes back to 1904, when the Herero's were massacred, and up until the present, when Semiyomi became president, and it sort of portrays or documents in a fictional and a featured way the struggles of the people and how they over many, many years through battles in the which was then the League of Nations, then the UN, and up until they finally got their independence, and it deals with from the people who took part in the struggle, from their approach, it's from their view, and it also was framed on the life story of Sammy Yoma, who was again the first president of Namibia.
Now Sammy Yoma is still in the land. Instead in the land of the living, and he was portrayed by a brother named Carl Lumdy, who was married to Vanetta McGee. Is that correct?
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I think.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say that he looks just like Sammy Yoma. Carl Lumdy with his beard and makeup and everything, and so we were very happy. And Sammy Yoma, interviewed him and gave the blessing. He gave us his blessings on the casting, so we're very happy with that.
And could you talk about? I saw the film in Toronto at a film festival there, but where has it been showcased, and how can people get a hold of it today?
Well, it hasn't been showcased very much. There was still some dispute over who owned the film. There were some issues about the producers and how much the government owns the film and so forth, and that hasn't been resolved. But it's been shown in different places. Not very many because of the whole argument over the debate of the film, the ownership of the film. But Cinema Libre is right now officially the distributor of the film, in a sense that they're the ones who are representing the film. And though they do have a distribution company, but they're looking for theatrical release and things like that, and trying to sell them.
Well, what is the problem with the ownership? What is the argument over?
Initially it was a joint project between the Film Commission, which is a government-owned entity in Namibia, and a group that was associated with the Pan-African Film Organization of Namibia, and they were going to get private funding to produce the film. And they were working on that. In the meantime, the Namibian government, through the Film Commission, was financing the film. And and kept financing the film and hoping that the independent, the private producers would come in and do their share of financing the film. And that didn't happen. Yet and still, the private individuals claimed that they still own part of the film because they initiated and things like that, even though they didn't put money into the film, but they had started the project. And so there's been an ongoing argument about that, and so that's where it stands.
I'm speaking with Charles Burnett, a producer and a director, great filmmaker out of Los Angeles, California. And I guess I wanted to talk to you about your first film, Killer of Sheep. I saw that many times, and I was really impressed with the story. I mean, it was basically a film about working class people in South Central Los Angeles. But could you talk about how that film came about? One, and I was really impressed on how you used music in that particular film. Could you talk about those two things?
Sure. You know, it was my thesis film at UCLA. And I was involved with, you know, other film students there making films. And it was a special group of film students who were interested in social change and that sort of thing like that. And they were making political films and films about, you know, management exploiting workers and things like that. But that wasn't my reality as such. I grew up with people who were just wanting a job, you know, and the whole idea was to hold on to a job and that sort of thing like that. And living in a condition where, you know, there wasn't very much incentive or anything like that. But the idea was I admired these people who worked and continued to work and took care of their family. And so it was sort of a homage to those people, you know. But I didn't want to do it in a way like a Hollywood film where, this sort of plotted situation where something happens and something follows that, and then the person wins and he lives happy ever after, you know.
Right.
You know, the guy gets the girl and so forth, you know. But that doesn't work. I mean, people endure. They continue doing what they're doing. People were successful and people weren't successful, but the main thing is that they took care of their families and they endured, you know. And to me, that was the thing that was heroic and that I can admire, the people who worked hard and in spite of everything, you know, had a moral focus and kept their family intact and worked hard to see that their kids were able to try to get them to do better than they did and that sort of thing. Because I grew up in that kind of a environment, you know. And so I thought that would reflect reality, a little slice of reality, and would counter the sort of narrative that Hollywood was always portraying about the lazy, you know, people of color and things like that, you know, always into dope and things like that. I wanted to show a story where people were survivors, you know, in spite of the conditions, and give a different take on what's going on in the community. Just a slice of life. It doesn't represent all the, you know, the total reality, but it represents, you know, a little slice of that experience and my friends, because it was a story told about them. About the people I grew up in that little corridor or number of blocks that I grew up in an environment. But the music was a very important part because it was music that I grew up with. You know, my mother used to play this music all the time, and I never really appreciated it until I got older. You know, and I didn't know how much I was brainwashed by it, in the sense that brainwashed meaning and a good thing, and that, you know, it was played over and over again, you're not really aware of it, but then later on you found out that it's seeped in your consciousness somehow, you know, and then you realize how much you miss. In fact, I remember, you know, these tunes just sort of like pop into my head, and I'm wondering where they come from, you know, and I had to go back and look through all the old 78s and find them, you know, in a certain strange way, cherish those records because, you know, there were, you know, those old 78s are cracking and they're breaking. You look at them, they're breaking. You know? But I wanted to preserve the music, and so I used the film on one hand to do that, and also because the music was one, the kind of, you know, music that Stan, the main character, would have grown up on, you know. And so it reflected that, and as well as trying to preserve a lot of these records. But also the music tells a story, and it's the blues, a lot of blues and things like that. If you listen to it, it sort of tells what these people are experiencing as well. It sort of supplements what's going on in the film.
Now, could you talk about My Brother's Wedding that came out in 1983?
Yeah, My Brother's Wedding. I had did, you know, having finished To Kill a Sheep, and you know, it's a rather dry documentary-like film, non-naturalistic film, and then I get this, questions about, well, I didn't have any humor, you know, it was sort of like about the working class, and well, underclass, you might say, I don't know. But anyway, and so I wanted to do something that would have a broader appeal as well, so I thought about My Brother's Wedding, and it came about, it's not based on my life entirely, but just one incident where I was invited to a wedding, and I accepted to go to the wedding and everything. You know, weddings are, you know, months in advance, you know, plan. And so this girl really wanted me to come to her wedding. I said, sure. And so she kept asking me all the time, are you going to come to her wedding? I said, yeah. And so there was always this doubt, and because she didn't have too many friends, because she had just moved out here, you know. So anyway, so the wedding starts, you know, getting closer and closer. But a friend of mine got killed, and for some reason, well, not for some reason, just the way faith is, that his funeral just was planned on the same day as the wedding, which had already been planned, in the same time, and I was sort of caught in the middle, so I was going to tell the young lady, because I thought this was more important, going to the funeral, that I wasn't going to be able to make the wedding. And as I was approaching her, and she looked at me and said, you're not going to tell me you're not coming to the wedding. And without me saying anything, and I just was too chicken to say, oh, no, I wasn't going to say that. No, I wasn't going to say anything at all, you know. And so so the wedding was, there's a slight period when, if the wedding came off on time, I could just barely make it to the funeral. If the wedding happened, and I can leave right after the, you know, the I do and ceremony and kissing the bride and all that kind of stuff, gone, bye, and make it to the funeral. But the wedding didn't happen on time. I was there, I went there first, and it was just dragged on and on because some relative was coming into town and the plane was late and all that sort of thing. And so I was doomed. And so I wanted to do a film about responsibility, about these young guys who sort of idolized, you know, the poor and had a sort of distorted view of the middle class. And like we did when we were kids, you know, so that's basically what I want to do, a story about a guy who becomes a brother's keeper, and he's irresponsible. He's a good guy in many ways, you know, has a good soul, but he's still irresponsible. I mean, it takes some understanding and maturity to function in the world, you know, and a lot of these guys didn't grow up, you know, being still, you know, they have good intentions, but, you know, and as a consequence, that leads to sort of sometimes a tragic situation or sad ending. So I wanted to sort of make a story about responsibility and irony and all that sort of thing.
Now let's fast forward to 1990. You did a film called To Sleep with Anger. Is that the most popular film you did in terms of people viewing that film? Or The Glass Shield be the most popular in terms of
viewing? Oh, no, you're right. The Glass Shield. Oh, and by the way, in My Brother's Wedding, I used Johnny Ace's music, as you did mention that earlier. But no, The Glass Shield has probably been shown more than any other film, because it's shown everywhere, all over the world, almost every month. I find every time I go somewhere, someone is always saying, I saw your film on TV, on cable, or some network, and the Netflix, or something like that, you know, almost all the time. And that's been going on for years, you know.
The Glass Shield, that's the one starring Ice Cube, right?
Well, it doesn't star Ice Cube, but he has a sort of a cameo part in it, a small part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a cameo part. He plays a key element. His situation is a key element in the story. Okay. But he's not the main character. I just say.
And To Sleep With Anger, that was Danny Glover and
Carl Lumley and Vanetta McGee.
And Vanetta McGee, the late Vanetta McGee, right.
Yeah, the late. And I was trying to think of the other people who were in there. They're all really great, you know. I like Shirley Ralph is in there, you know.
Shirley Ralph, she does a lot of work around the AIDS question here in Los Angeles, right?
Uh-huh. She does a lot of good humanitarian work, like Danny Glover. He's all over the place, particularly in Africa, and trying to call attention to the plight of people in those areas and things.
Right. You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Norman Richmond. I'm speaking with Charles Burnett, filmmaker Charles Burnett, and the person that is really that's not really got his due. But could we talk about the state of black films or African cinema in North America and around the world? And could you talk about some of the film festivals and the importance of the film festivals in the United States and all over the world?
Well, I'll try to. I mean, I'm not a sort of student. I just, just in the mix more or less about studying it. One of the, the Pan-African Film Festival is about to start in February,
Right.
And right here in L.A., Babu runs it and his wife. And it's one of the most important film festivals in the world, in a sense, because it sort of showcases all of the films throughout the diaspora. They come and they play in L.A. For a week or so, and it's one of the best attended festivals. And it exposes people in L.A. and people who come visit to all these films that you would never see, and it won't find the distribution. And it certainly has, and particularly film festivals throughout the world has helped, to sort of launch, black independent films, because in the late 70s when they had film festivals like in France, in Berlin, and Amsterdam, and all those places like that, they had a special section called Black Independent Films that they started, I think for the first time in a sense, where it became. Where black independent films were recognized and on that level. They had, films shown in France and Cannes and things like that, but this is one when they had a specific section designated for black independent films, and American films, to a large extent, sort of launched that. I know in Berlin, Ewan Gregor had a whole series of black independent films. This was in the 80s, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and my film won there, and I remember, Haile's film was in Cannes, and
Haile Gwerima.
Haile Gwerima's film won in Cannes, and all over, so it became, and Europeans started writing about these independent films, you never got that sort of press or attention in the States, when we won at the Berlin Critics Prize, it was all over the European press, and came here, wasn't even mentioned.
What film did you win for? My brother's wedding? Oh,
no,
Sheep, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Killer Sheep. And Bill Gunn, when we were in Paris, all of us, a group of us, Bill Gunn, Kathy Collins, I think Haile Gwerima, and a whole bunch of Wharton Huntley and all these folks like that, and Bill Greaves, and we were celebrated in Paris. And Bill Gunn was telling me that when he was in Cannes a couple of years earlier with Ganja and Hess, that there was such a surprise film there, and he was getting all this press and all this sort of thing like that, and the reporters and the press was falling to the air, to the steps of the plane, you know, talking to him and trying to get, you know, more and more interviews and things like that. You know, it was riotous. And then when he gets to the States, nothing. You know, and so we all sort of shared the same experience in many ways. You know, but those festivals have been really helpful. And you know, the Ouagadougou and things like that. You know, Pessoa, I should say, and you know, has sort of presented, you know, African films on the continent. You know, everyone sort of, it's a lot like, it comes every other year. For some of the films, you have the Carthage Film Festival and things like that. You know, all of those things have been very, very helpful to sustain, you know, filmmaking for, you know, people of color. You know, so they are really essential. Otherwise, we'd be working in a vacuum. You know, and like, if you want to get a good example of just the energy and the passion, come to the Pan African Film Festival. You would see people dressed in, you know, costume, you know, African costumes and things like that, and they wait. They take their vacation during this period. You know, and the discussions after the fest, after the films. You know, the filmmaker, it's great. I mean, you know, you can't find a more intelligent audience, you know. They're just, you know, really, really are enthusiastic about, you know, having these films that, you know, where they can see them, you know. And also the filmmaker.
I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No, I was going to say, it really, you know, a lot of us don't get enough attention, you know, and a lot and positive vibes and things like that, you know, because you sort of work in a vacuum, and you're always being challenged, and there's always a sense of failure and denial and stuff like that, you know. And then when you come to an environment where people really appreciate what you're doing, it makes you go on and want to make more films.
Right.
Yeah, it's inspiring.
Now, Asantewaa and Babu are... of the people that are behind the Pan-African Film Festival. And before I go to the next question, I wanted to let the listeners know that this year, Gerald Horn, who has been a, you know, guest on Uhuru Radio many, many, many times, is going to be doing a part of a panel that they're doing on slavery, which I guess is a result of the discussion that has been started by Django. But I wanted to say that... I was doing some research, and I found out that Martin Delaney and Frederick Douglass had done novels. And in these novels, the plot is basically where a, you know, black man, you know, comes to the rescue of his significant other. You know, so this, a lot of things that Tarantino is getting credit for, you know, it's already a part of our history, of African history. But I guess I wanted to spend the last few minutes that we have about 7 minutes talking about distribution and making films. People have argued that the problem with there's not a Hollywood will not fund films, so people are saying, okay, we can't depend on Hollywood, so we should go abroad. We can go to Africa, we can go to China, or we can go to India, and that's one way of solving the problem. Then the other people like yourself have said that there are tons of great films that are in the can, black films that are in the can that have never been distributed. The issue is distribution. Could you talk about those questions?
Yeah, I don't know if India or China, those things, or any kind of panacea. I mean, the independent filmmakers are struggling there as well. I mean, it's all over when you have Hollywood films dominating the industry, you know, things like that. You know, it's a problem. And you have their own filmmakers trying to get financing, so it's in competition, and you're at a disadvantage. I mean, the thing is just the problem is distribution. I mean, you can probably it's hard, but you can maybe get money to do a film. The thing is, how do you make the money back, and how do you get distribution? Even in the States, if you just get distribution in the States, you'll be all right, you know. All the theaters are occupied or dominated by Hollywood, you know. And then you have to get an audience that's that will support you. And now, had an audience to show that there is that there, but if the venues are not there, I mean, the theaters and things like that, you have to find a different mechanism to show the films. There may be like small digital screens in the community, and you have to start, you know, four-walling or doing something of that nature where, you know, you can get the films out there. Let's take an example. If you go to a conventional route and advertise in the paper, like the Times, whatever it is, Wall Street Journal, I mean, New York Post, whatever is watching it, those advertisements cost millions of dollars. So you do a film for whatever cost it is, X amount of money, you will spend to compete on a regular basis with all those other ads and the, you know, movie ads, like millions of dollars. You know, if a film may cost $60 million, they may spend, I mean, like a Hollywood film, they may spend $25 million on advertising or more, you know, on prints and ads. And so and TV ads, you know, just on the Super Bowl, how much those ads would cost, you know. It's prohibited for an independent filmmaker to do that. It has to be a grassroots kind of situation where you go around that mechanism and you work directly in the community, you know, and also in Africa as well. I mean, you try to create these networks where you can distribute your film and avoid pirating, you know, with people, you know, where that's the most...
That's important.
Deadly, yeah, it's a killer for independent films, because just say you make a film for whatever amount of money, X amount of money, let's say $100,000, $200,000, you know, and someone's, you know, pirates your film, they're out in the street selling your film, you know, somehow they got a copy of it, made other copies and other copies, you know, and they make that $200,000 or $300,000 that you would have made selling your film and being able to pay your creditors back, you can't. You know, so you're dead in the water. You have a film that you can't make any money out, because people have robbed you by selling the film out from under you, you know. And so that's a serious, like Hailey, for example. Hailey was telling me he was walking down in some street in Manhattan, and some brother was selling his film, you know, and there's nothing he can do about it, you know. And that could have been money going into his pocket to produce another film. Now that won't happen because of that. You know, there's a lot of things that has to be in place, but it's a more complicated thing. But distribution is a thing where the money, where the making the money and making your film, you get into an audience and being able to sustain yourself by getting revenue from that. And it's kept a big secret. I mean, like, yeah, it's hard to get a film. But it's easier to competitively speaking to make it than to distribute it. Because if you, let's say for example, if you borrow money from whoever, you know, and it takes you a year to make the film, and then you can't sell it, you have it for a couple of years trying to sell it. In the meantime, interest and people you owe are clamoring about, where is my money, you know? And that drains you, and if you don't sell it, you have to compromise, just give it away almost, you know? And hope you get some recognition, but me not getting the money. You know, and festivals. One of the good things about festivals is that it gives you that exposure, but you also have to know how to work the festivals, because if you had a means of distributing the film as you using the festival market, that would save you a lot of money in terms of advertising, because you know, if you get good reviews from the festival, you can use that to promote your film. If you can open it at the same time right after the festival, it would be even better. And that's what the Pan-African Film Festival tries to do and wants to do with these films, is try to get a distribution or open it right after, or get some sort of a release for the film during or after the festival. And there's been some examples of where that has worked, you know. And I think you mentioned Babu, he can give you the name of the films, because I know that was one particular one that... what's the name of this film? I'm sorry, it escapes me, but it was out last year, 2 years ago, and my memory is too short.
Is it from the continent, or from the Caribbean, or from the North America?
It's from the continent of Africa.
South Africa? Is it the South Africa?
No, it's just what's... Kinshasa, Yeah, that's what, yeah, the filmmaker from Kinshasa, and it takes place there.
From Congo, yes.
Kinshasa, yeah. Kinshasa.
We can find it and we post it on the website, but we have only a minute or two left. I basically want to know, do you have a website? How can people, if they want to get a hold of Charles Burnett, how can they do that?
Well, they can. I have an email that people can reach me at, and that's C Burnett Inc. with one T, you know, CBURNETINC at AOL.com.
All right. Is there anything else you would like to add?
I can't think of anything at the moment. You know, I usually after I hang up. Oh, I should have said this. Oh, I should have said that, and so forth, and all that sort of thing. You know, you think of after you hang up and after it's gone. You know,
this won't be the last time we have you on. This won't be the last time you'll be on the show. So,
yeah,
you can just save it the next time.
I will then. Yeah.
All right. So thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure too.
All right. We have been speaking with Charles Burnett, great filmmaker and director, and we continue with our tribute to Eric Allan Dolphy, Jr.
And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen. That was Norman Otis Richmond out of L.A. Last week's show on diasporic music. His show is on Uruhu Radio every Sunday from 2 to 4 live. So if you want to check that out, he's going to have another show tomorrow at 2 to 4. If you're on the West Coast, it's 11 to 1.